This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Men in uniform, they should solve the issue of machine gun rule. If they want to rule by gun, they should inform the country that we are now running a dictatorship and no longer a democracy.
That's Willie Mayambala, one of the Ugandan presidential candidates who have suspended their campaigns after a violent crackdown and arrest of fellow candidate Bobi Wine. Also, more than 30,000 people flee to Sudan because of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The conflict in Ethiopia between the federal government and the regional ruling party TPLF has forced more than 30,000 people to flee to Sudan, according to the UN Refugee Agency. VOA Salem Salomon reports on the human toll brought on by the conflict.
The border town of Hamdayet, Sudan, is home to thousands of refugees fleeing violence in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Among the estimated thousands who have arrived in recent days are the parents of seven-month-old twins born prematurely, lying on a bed in a makeshift shelter. The family was forced to leave the hospital in Tigray where they were getting medical care. Burhanu Gordafai is the twins' father.
They were in incubators, but when the city was bombed, we ran away and came here. Their mother doesn't have much milk. We are using flour and mixing it to feed them. That is not recommended by doctors. Our children are dying right before our eyes.
The conflict in Ethiopia between the federal government and the regional ruling party, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, has forced more than 30,000 people to flee Sudan, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Avru Gonzos is an Ethiopian refugee in Alfashka, Sudan.
If it wasn't for Sudan, many would be dead. Where do we go? If we go to Eritrea, they will slaughter us. If we go to Gondar, they will slaughter us. Where would we go if it wasn't for Sudan?
The violence escalated after fighters loyal to the TPLF allegedly attacked a federal government position. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed responded by ordering airstrikes and sending in troops. The Ethiopian federal government says its onslaught is a limited military action against some members of the TPLF. The TPLF says this is a war against Tigray. In Maykadra, Ethiopia, Amnesty International said it documented a mass killing of hundreds of civilians by attackers whose identities are not confirmed. Sam Deverley of Amnesty International says those killed are not involved in military operations.
They were all indeed men of working age, and we were told by eyewitnesses that these were day laborers who were not involved in the ongoing military offensive. But most of the bodies were covered. There were too many to count, to be honest with you. But definitely we saw scores of bodies in the videos, and we've been told there were hundreds of people who were killed in this attack.
The Ethiopian government has blamed the attack on the TPLF, which has denied involvement. The United Nations called for an investigation. Deverley, the head of Amnesty's evidence lab that examined video and photo evidence of the attacks, told VOA the rights group is painstaking in its investigation.
We spent a lot of time going through these images, trying to establish exactly where and when they were taken. And then we also sent some of the images to an independent pathologist who confirmed the nature of the wounds.
He said there is little reliable information filtering outside the country due to a government-imposed internet shutdown in the Tigray region.
Human rights investigators, human rights monitors, is making the job of humanitarian workers all that much harder to really ensure that civilians are protected. If the Ethiopian authorities want to be taken, they want to be seen to be doing their job of ensuring accountability on all sides, then that internet shutdown needs to be lifted.
Meanwhile, the number of those seeking refuge in Sudan is growing rapidly. While sheltering in Gedaref-state Sudan, a woman from the Kemant ethnic group who fled said she and other women fled with nothing but children clinging to their backs.
The children don't have anything to drink and eat. All of us are suffering. We don't have clothes. We have borrowed from our neighbors to wear the clothes we have. We ask the Tigray regional government and governments around the world to raise their heads and look at us.
Fevrek Tesfay, a Tigrayan refugee who's one of the thousands fleeing conflict and sheltering in Hamdayet, said the attacks target specific groups.
War is meaningless. Even if the central government is cooperate with Eritrean government and with Amhara region, together they fight or kill specifically to Tigray people.
The Ethiopian Prime Minister vows the final and crucial military operation will soon begin. Salim Salomon, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Army Chief General Birhanu Juma has accused World Health Organization Director General, fellow Ethiopian Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, of lobbying other countries to provide arms and other support to the defiant Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF. According to the Associated Press, before his WHO posting, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus served as Ethiopia's foreign and health minister at a time when the TPLF dominated Ethiopia's ruling coalition. The Ethiopian army chief pointed out that Tedros was a member of the TPLF party and said, "What do you expect from a person like him?" There was no immediate response from WHO headquarters or from Tedros. Ugandan presidential candidates have suspended their campaigns after a brutal police crackdown on supporters of popular musician Bobby Wine left at least 7 dead and 45 wounded. Police fired tear gas and live rounds to disperse a campaign rally yesterday, saying Wine was flouting COVID-19 restrictions that the opposition says are intended to cripple efforts to unseat long-serving President Yoweri Museveni. Journalists also were roughed up. Wine, a legislator whose real name is Robert Chagulani Santamu, was arrested as he addressed the rally. He remained in custody today, and his party says no one has been allowed to see him. The other candidates say they are suspending their activities until Wine is released. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
With Bobby Wine still behind bars, other presidential candidates say they feel it's not safe to continue campaigning. John Katumba is the youngest contender.
Today we have nothing to do because we cannot continue doing our things when our brothers are still in jail.
William Ayambala, another presidential candidate, says he won't continue his campaign until police explain their actions.
If a Ugandan like us, he deserves the right to campaign and do everything as constitutionally accepted. Men in uniform, they should solve the issue of machine gun rule. If they want to rule by gun, they should inform the country that we are now running a dictatorship and no longer a democracy.
Henry Tumukunde, another presidential candidate, also halted his campaign in protest. He says police have selectively zeroed in on frustrating opposition campaigns under the guise of implementing COVID-19 guidelines.
Go and tell the people we are unable to reach them. This is the election we are going through. And you heard the police chief saying, I'm the one who tells you where to go.
Mugisha Muntu, another presidential candidate, condemned the continued impunity with the continued harassment of opposition politicians.
If the regime can act in that manner, in blatant disregard of the act itself being covered on TV, that shows you the level of recklessness and desperation at which this regime is as of now.
The arrest of Bobby Wine sparked protests across the country. A number of election observers and politicians are calling for suspension of campaigns to avoid further loss of life. Charity Ahimisiwe is the executive director of election observer body Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda.
If the Electoral Commission and the police agreed that breaking of COVID-19 rules equals to death of Ugandans, then the better way forward is to suspend campaigns and we appear for elections on the last day of elections without any campaigns. It doesn't help any Ugandan when any of us is lost, when anyone dies because of an election.
Chagulanyi's National Unity Platform Party says the arrest of their candidate has greatly affected their campaigns but will not break their zeal. Joel Senyonyi is the party spokesperson.
So obviously they've cut his feet, but regardless, we are here. Eventually, when they get to release him, we'll start from where we have stopped. Of course, the challenge therein is that the days are few, and it's deliberate. It's deliberate. When they hold him here, even for just one day, it hurts us because we had about 53 days to campaign in 146 districts.
Security has been heavily deployed on various roads in urban areas today in an effort to tamp down public anger. Police maintain that they will ensure that candidates comply with the COVID-19 rules. 8 candidates are in the race to unseat Museveni, who has been in power for the past 34 years. Elections are set for January 19th. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
After blocking the only road linking Morocco to Mauritania at Grougret, the Polisario announced that it would no longer abide by the 1991 ceasefire agreement. Morocco reopened the border crossing and has reiterated its commitment to the agreement and stressed that its military action in Grougret was intended to consolidate the ceasefire by preventing more incidents that threaten regional security and stability. William Lawrence, professor of political science and international relations at the American University in Washington, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the rising tension in Western Sahara.
Neither side wants a full-blown war. Both sides have been testing the limits of the ceasefire in certain ways in recent years and months. One of the complicating aspects of this is that the Polisario side has civilian protesters backed by military that block roads and create checkpoints. So it starts with a sort of a civilian protest act, and then those protesters are backed up by military forces. So you can see it either as a military provocation from the beginning or just an act of civil disobedience that morphs into a military conflagration. But neither side wants a full-blown war. Both sides are trying to draw attention to the issue to their own advantage. And the UN is relatively ineffectual these days, in part just due to a lack of attention to the issue and the fact that they're mostly focused on the limitations that COVID-19 places on what the peacekeeping mission can do. And so, you know, it remains to be seen whether either side will gain any sort of advantage or whether this is just jockeying for position in order to get the international spotlight on the issue to see things the way they want it to be seen.
But how does the Polisario withdrawal from the 1991 ceasefire affect the situation on the ground?
If it is a full-blown withdrawal from the ceasefire and we have a full-blown war going, that's very serious. You know, it could implicate Algeria, which has backed Polisario, and it could bring back the very hot war that we've been avoiding recur in the area since 1991. But what I see it is, it's more trying to draw attention to the frozen conflict. Because of the failure of years of attempts at negotiation where no serious progress was made, Polisario really has nothing to lose to provoke the international community into paying attention to the conflict.
So what do you make of the Algerian government's statement that Morocco has violated the ceasefire?
Algeria is always going to side with Polisario in this issue, so, you know, each side is going to blame the other for the violations. And it is true that it's the Moroccan side that's been firing on the other side first. So technically the Algerians are correct, but the Moroccans are being provoked because their trucking is being stopped from passing through the region. As you know, a blockade is an act of war. So insofar as you have to break the blockade with a warlike action, you know, who's the one that's breaking the ceasefire? The one that's blockading or the one that's trying to break the blockade? But the Algerian position is more of a posturing than it is an analysis of who's responsible for the situation.
The international community has called for restraint and dialogue. UN Secretary General, European Union Foreign Minister, and African Union are all engaged in diplomatic efforts to defuse the crisis brought by the repeated Polisario violations of UN Security Council resolutions. Would this involvement lead to a de-escalation of the situation in the Western Sahara?
I think so, because neither side wants a full-blown war. The official mediator here is the UN Secretary General. We have not had the envoy position filled for over a year after the last envoy left. And I don't think the EU or the AU are in a position to be the mediator of the situation. So that position will need to be filled by an effective diplomat. And hopefully this will prompt the UN Secretary General to name an envoy as soon as possible. But I think that since neither side wants a full-blown war, whatever mediation effort will probably lead to a tamping down of the conflict.
So what can we expect from the U.S.?
The United States has had a relatively positive experience lately with regional mediation, where its mediators, either through the U.N. or independent of the U.N., have been successful in either brokering deals or getting close to brokered deals. So the U.S. actually, when it applies itself in the situation, can have some effect on the ground in the mediating role. But at this time, there is no official in place that's designated to take on this role. So it would be, I think, highly beneficial for the U.S. to work through the U.N. in naming an envoy. And the first move will be for the U.S. to pressure the U.N. to fill the envoy position and then get about getting the ceasefire back into place.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science and international relations at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawy. The head of South Africa's Commission of Inquiry into Organized Corruption, known as State Capture, has dismissed former President Jacob Zuma's application for him to recuse himself from the case for alleged bias. Zuma claimed Zondo has already made up his mind that he is guilty, but as Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, a defiant Zuma left the court during the tea break, forcing the commission to adjourn.
In his judgment, Judge Zondo tore into all arguments advanced by Zuma for him to recuse himself. He denied Zuma's contention that they were friends whose relations soured, saying he has never had a personal friendship with the former president. Zuma also argued that he was not given a chance to defend himself, but Zondo said the former president resisted many attempts to appear before the commission to an extent that twice he had to issue orders to force him to come.
I conclude that the applicant has failed to meet the test for a reasonable apprehension of bias. Accordingly, I conclude that the application for my recusal falls to be dismissed, and it is accordingly dismissed.
Soon after the ruling, the State Capture Commission evidence leader, Paul Pretorius, asked for Zuma to be put on the witness stand to testify.
Our position is the summons still stands, and the applicant, Mr. Zuma, must now answer questions. In short, the proceedings must continue. And if they are excusing themselves from the proceedings, the applicant would be acting in defiance of the summons and unlawfully.
Zuma's lawyer, Moses Kakane, objected.
I think I have a duty to tell the chair why we will excuse ourselves so that it's not called a walkout or defiance, but we will excuse ourselves right now. You have become a judge in the dispute that involves yourself. We've also been instructed to lodge a complaint about you in that regard to the Judicial Service Commission.
Pretorius then asked Zondo to rule on Zuma's refusal to take the stand. But Zuma was nowhere to be found after the tea break, forcing the commission to adjourn prematurely. Lawson Naidu is a constitutional law expert.
Deputy Chief Justice can take action in that regard to the extent of, appealing to a court to issue a warrant for his arrest for failing to adhere to a duly issued summons.
Zuma's lawyer had indicated they would seek a High Court review of Zondo's dismissal of their recusal effort. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South African authorities are fuming after a judge in Malawi granted bail to a church leader and his wife accused of a string of financial crimes in South Africa. Malawian police yesterday arrested self-proclaimed prophet Shepherd Bushiri and his wife Mary following a request from Pretoria for their extradition. But hours later, they were again free. The Bushiris were also recently given bail in South Africa, then fled the country last Wednesday for their homeland. Darren Taylor reports.
South African investigators say the Bushiris have used several illegal businesses and their Pretoria-based evangelical church, the Enlightened Christian Gathering, to steal $1.2 million. The couple deny this, saying the allegations are revenge because they refused to pay bribes to senior police officers. They say they fled South Africa because their lives were in danger. Authorities here are now asking, now that Prophet Bushiri's once again been freed, this time in Malawi, what's to stop him from fleeing elsewhere? It's not a valid question, says Malawi's Information Minister Gospel Kazako.
Certainly, if he was someone who was going to flee, I don't know how he could have actually come and presented himself to the police. But at the same time, why should he flee from Malawi? He left South Africa, went through your borders, and then made Malawi his choice of place to be. So if he had any other place that was safer than Malawi, he would have probably started off from South Africa to that place where he felt he was safe or everything was going to be all right.
An expert in Southern African immigration law, Gary Eisenberg, says Bushiri's choice of Malawi as a safe haven could be a very clever move, and one based on Shepherd Bushiri's knowledge of legal protocol in the Southern African Development Community, or SADC.
The SADC protocol may oblige the Malawian government to refuse to hand him over at the end of the day. They may have an international obligation not to extradite him, even after all the extradition process has concluded in Malawi itself, which could take a long time. There are various grounds in the SADC protocol which would prevent Malawi from extraditing him. For example, not getting a fair trial in South Africa.
Eisenberg says another reason not to send the Bushiris back to Pretoria for trial is if the Malawian authorities decide there's sufficient evidence to believe their lives are indeed at risk in South Africa. The preacher has previously reported being threatened by police here and of surviving an alleged assassination attempt. Kazako says there should be no doubt that Malawi will comply with all laws regarding the fate of the Bushiris.
Malawi has one of the best judicial systems in the world. Malawi judicial system is an award winner at global level. It is a winner of the Chatham House of the United Kingdom.
The respected London-based Policy Institute recently awarded its Chatham House Prize to Malawi's Constitutional Court judges. This for their bravery and independence in overturning the illegal re-election in 2019 of former President Peter Mutharika and ordering new elections that put President Lazarus Chakwera in office. According to Eisenberg, the South African government should feel deeply embarrassed by the Bushiri saga.
Reverend Bushiri and his wife have been in South Africa since 2009. Preaching, setting up businesses, buying aeroplanes, buying properties, setting up an enterprise worth hundreds of millions of rands on apparently fake permanent residence permits. Let's begin there.
From then on, says the lawyer, Bushiri simply toys with local authorities.
He simply hands in one set of passports in order to get bail of 200,000 rand and then suddenly crosses the border using passports that the South African government didn't realize that he possessed.
Eisenberg says the Bushiri case shows that because of the ineptitude and corruption of some government departments in South Africa, the country's national security is at high risk. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international